Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where every week we explore the Parsha through the lens of books and articles that I have read over Shabbos. Keep reading every Shabbos. Thank you so much to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem, and I am so grateful for their partnership and friendship. It's probably more than 20 years ago that I heard a lecture from my Rebbe, friend, mentor, Rev Yehoshua Hartman. I know Rev Yehoshua Hartman for many, many years. You can check out his shiurim on the All Parsha app if you circle up. I don't know where you are on the app. Swipe up, swipe left, swipe right, but he's on there. His Torah is absolutely phenomenal. I first got to meet him because he lived down the block from my sister when he lived in Israel, and when my sister lived, she continues to live in Israel, but she lives in Har Nof. On Rehov HaKablan, he lived down the block. I would go there for Shabbos. I spent some very messy Purim Sudas there with my other Rebbe, Rev Ari Waxman from Yeshiva Shalavim. I have some pictures of that I hope never see the light of day. And that he used to come visit every now and then. I remember I one time drove him from where he was staying in Baltimore back to the Yeshiva. This is, believe it or not, in a time before GPS, and that 10 to 15 minute car ride took about an hour because I got absolutely lost with my dear friend Levi Okin. But that Shabbos, he spent in Baltimore, and I spent Shabbos with my Zadie, Oliva Shalom, and his wife. She should continue to live and be well, Grandma Millie Shapiro. And I went to hear him because he's such an influence. He's so well known through his edition of the Maharal that is footnoted, these blue Maharals that I'm sure you've seen in a Beis Medrash. They're all over the place. And he gave a shiur on Shabbos morning that posed a fascinating question that he had heard from his Rebbe, Rav Yitzchak Huttner. The question was, when was the Akedah over? Of course, he is referring to Akedas Yitzchak, the harrowing and haunting story of God telling Avraham to sacrifice his son Yitzchak. And as anybody familiar with the story knows, which is recounted in our Parsha in Perek Chaf Beis, the 22nd chapter of Bereishis of Genesis, that as Avraham is about to sacrifice his son, an angel calls out and beckons him, please stop. This is usually where people end the story. This is probably the story, if I were to ask my son, can you recount the story of Akedas Yitzchak? That's probably where he would stop the story. But in fact, the Torah continues. Avraham finds another ram that is ne'echaz besvach, it's caught in the bushes, and sacrifices that ram instead. Now, usually, at least when I first read the story, this seemed to be like a convenient postscript to an otherwise concluded story. The story was over, he didn't sacrifice his son, and then there's like a P.S., you know, he found something else to sacrifice. Hooray, you know, good news, bad news. You know, the ram's going to get it, but Yitzchak is safe. But that question still fascinates me, and I think it is a really important question. When was the Akedah over? Kind of left with this question. Is it over when Avraham stops and he listens to the Malach and doesn't sacrifice his son? In some ways, there are people who read the story this way. Rav Kook famously writes in his commentary on his Siddur that this was the point of the entire story. When the Malach cries out, the Altasa lo mi'uma, do not raise your hand against this child. Do not harm him. Al tashlich yadcha el hanar v'al tas lo mi'uma. Rav Kook feels that is kind of the climax of the story. He writes that explicitly in his Siddur. That is what is the enduring message of this story. But that leaves the question, what is that postscript of sacrificing the ayil, the ram that is nechaz besvach? There is another question. It's less of a question, almost like an enduring curiosity, a fascinating part of dialogue in the story of Akedas Yitzchak, and that is when Yitzchak and Avram speak to one another. Yitzchak only has two spoken words in the entire story. The ones that are most famous is when Yitzchak asked, Hine ha'esh v'ha'etzem v'ha'aya v'haseh v'aye haseh la'ola. I see the wood, I see the fire. Where is the sheep that is going to be burnt? But there is an exchange just before that that is so powerful and so moving, and the question is, what exactly is it for? Before Yitzchak says his most famous line of dialogue, there is a line right before that where he says, Vayomer Yitzchak el Avram Aviv. Yitzchak says to Avram his father, Vayomer Avi, and he says, my father, Vayomer Hineni, and Avram answers back, Hineni Bini, yes, my son, I am here. What exactly is this exchange? It is before Yitzchak asks the question? Is that just an introduction to his question? Yitzchak calls out to Avram and says, Father, and Avram responds and says, Hineni bini, yes, my son. What is this prologue to Yitzchak's ultimate question, kind of understanding what exactly is going on? There's fire, there's wood, but where exactly is the burnt offering come from? Where the doom and the pain of this story finally descends on Yitzchak? What is that introduction where he calls out and just says, Aviv, my father, and Avram responds, Hineni bini? That is question number two. And finally, just a general question about Yitzchak's life, giving all the traumatic details of everything he goes through. His name feels very dissonant with his life experience. Yitzchak is given his name because it provided his mother Sarah with laughter when she found out that she was going to be pregnant. But when you look at Yitzchak's life, it feels to be filled with sorrow, nearly sacrificed by his father, fighting among his children Yaakov and Esav, and living the end of his life without his ability to see. What is it about Yitzchak's life, if anything, that makes his namesake, laughter, fitting and appropriate? And to understand all of these questions, I want to explore the life and legacy of Elie Wiesel and all of his work bearing testimony to the horrors of the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel, as you may already know, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. When he was accepting that award, he said as follows, "Do I have the right to represent the multitudes who have perished? Do I have the right to accept this great honor on their behalf? I do not. That would be presumptuous. No one may speak for the dead. No one may interpret their mutilated dreams and visions." Elie Wiesel was witness to those mutilated dreams and vision when he was just 15 years old. He was born in 1928. And when he was 15, he and his family were deported by the Nazis to Auschwitz from his hometown of Sieget, which I don't know that I'm pronouncing it correctly. I believe that is also the hometown of Rav Menashe Klein, who wrote the Mishnah Halachos, as well as Professor David Weiss Halivni. I think they all came from Sieget. Elie Wiesel's family was murdered in the Holocaust. His parents, his sister, and really so much of his town was wiped out. After the war, Elie Wiesel became a journalist. Most people did not think anyone at that point had the capacity to hear the details of the experiences of the Holocaust, and most survivors were not yet ready to share them. Joseph Berger has an incredible biography on Wiesel that is part of the Yale Jewish Live series. And let me just say right now, nearly every book that I have read in that series is absolutely phenomenal. I would really recommend it to anyone. In particular, Yehuda Mirsky's biography of Rav Kook is one of the first books as part of this Yale Jewish Live series. The whole thing is phenomenal. They have biographies on Herzl, on Rav Menashe Ben Yisroel, on Harry Houdini, on all sorts of figures. It's a fantastic series. One of the ones that I love the most was Aviva Zornberg's biography on Moshe Rabbeinu, which happens to be phenomenal, really outstanding. There are so many fascinating biographies, and one of them was written by Joseph Berger called Elie Wiesel Confronting the Silence, and there he quotes from one literary agent who was trying to get Wiesel's manuscript sold about his experiences in the Holocaust and stated bluntly, nobody wanted to hear about concentration camps. They really struggled to find a publisher for his memoir about his experiences in the Holocaust, which eventually did, of course, become an international bestseller, especially when it was featured on Oprah's reading list. Tells you the importance of a national reading list. I'm no Oprah, but I'm hoping that we can get there over the course of our work, sharing books, articles, and ideas. In those early years as a journalist, Wiesel ended up telling other stories. He wrote for the Yiddish newspaper, The Forvitz, and also served as the foreign correspondent to the United Nations for the Hebrew newspaper, Yediot Achronot. My dearest friend, Menachem Butler, who so much of my love, interest, and knowledge of Jewish history comes from, his ideas, his emails, and everything that he has shared over the years, wrote a fantastic article for Tablet Magazine called Elie Wiesel Visits Disneyland. In that article, which is really phenomenal, actually, Menachem uncovered this Yiddish article that has gotten zero attention from when Elie Wiesel actually visited Disneyland. And there's a moment where he actually approached Walt Disney himself and asks, the whole world loves you. Your children's films have brought you honor, renown, and anything one could wish for. I want to ask you, this is Elie Wiesel's question to the actual Walt Disney. What is your goal? What do you want? What would you want to achieve with your film work? And Wiesel writes that Disney thought for a little bit, fixing his large eyes on a far off invisible point in space, and answered, childhood. The goal of my work has always been to awaken a sense of youth in men and adults, because the best part of man's life in his childhood. And Wiesel concludes, today I visited not only Disneyland, but also and especially my childhood. All the while, Elie Wiesel was working on his manuscript that eventually became his best-selling book entitled Night. It was first published in French under the title, don't think I'm even going to attempt to pronounce this, La Nuit, here we go, which was translated into English in 1960 and details Wiesel's life before the Holocaust and all he lost with it. Many were not yet ready to listen to the atrocities of the Holocaust. There's a haunting photograph that I've been thinking about, especially recently, given everything that's going on in Eretz Yisrael, that was captured by Joseph Wheaton, who was a photographer in the U.S. Army, part of their kind of psychological trauma division. And there's this haunting photograph he has, and you could look it up. Again, it's Joseph Eaton, E-A-T-O-N, of German prisoners of war who were forced to watch footage from the Holocaust to know what had happened. And you see people literally covering their faces. It is scary to live in a world where this is literally what Israel just had to do to kind of show the world the atrocities that happened. Elie Wiesel dedicated the remainder of his life to sharing the horror and memory of those lost. As Alan Berger writes in his review of Wiesel's memoir writing in general, Wiesel is Judaism's de facto shliach tzibur. He was the public representative of Jewish memory. Memory permits us, as Wiesel writes in his memoir, All Rivers Run to the Sea, to live in more than one world, to prevent the past from fading, and to call upon the future to illuminate it. He wanted to disturb society. For me, Elie Wiesel writes, literature must have an ethical dimension. The aim of the literature I call testimony is to disturb. Wiesel didn't write so his audience would like his book. He writes about Night. In the end, I decided that if people liked what I had written, they had not understood. Testimony like mine should have aroused anger. He wanted to provoke society to really understand the horrors, to bear witness to the horrors of the Holocaust. Wiesel's writing really turned us all into witnesses in a way. There is a scholar named Kristin Zulka who wrote an article in Modern Judaism, which is kind of a contemporary journal of Jewish studies, called Elie Wiesel and a Legacy of Post Witnessing, and the word post before witnessing is in parentheses. And they write over there, a person can become a witness of traumatic events retrospectively and also in real time. Regarding the Shoah, this person becomes part of a chain of testimony as a secondary witness. First-hand accounts of victims who did not or did survive are transmitted to the world audience. Readers, those who listen to oral testimony, scholars, etc., like the survivor who speaks for those who cannot speak for themselves anymore. The person who recalls the testimony of those who perish becomes a surrogate witness. Perhaps the power of storytelling is actually what drew Elie Wiesel into Hasidic thought. Some of his most beautiful writing is about Hasidic thinking and ideas. Among Elie Wiesel's most enchanted writing is all about Hasidic stories. He begins his novel, The Gates of the Forest, with the following Hasidic story. It's a famous one, but I'm going to repeat it because he tells it over so beautifully. When the great Israel Baal Shem Tov saw misfortune threatening the Jews, it was his custom to go into a certain part of the forest to meditate. There, he would light a fire, say a special prayer, and the miracle would be accomplished and the misfortune averted. Later, when his disciple, the celebrated Maggid of Mezrich, had occasion for the same reason to intercede with heaven, he would go to the same place in the forest and say, Master of the universe, listen, I do not know how to light the fire, but I am still able to say the prayer. And again, the miracle would be accomplished. Still later, Rav Moshe Lev Sasov, in order to save his people once more, would go into the forest and say, I do not know how to light the fire, I do not know the prayer, but I know the place, and this must be sufficient. It was sufficient, and the miracle was accomplished. Then it fell to Rabbi Israel of Rezhin to overcome misfortune. Sitting in his armchair, his head in his hands, he spoke to God. I am unable to light the fire, and I do not know the prayer. I cannot even find the place in the forest. All I can do is to tell the story, and this must be sufficient. And it was sufficient. God, Elie Wiesel writes, made man because he loves stories. The The horrors that Elie Wiesel witnessed profoundly affected his faith, but he never stopped believing in God. In a meeting with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe urged him not just to keep his faith intact, but to emerge even stronger. He wrote letters to him and told him that as difficult as it may seem, emerging from Auschwitz, not just with the faith intact, not believing despite what he had witnessed, but now his belief needed to be even stronger. And he did. Despite everything he witnessed, Elie Wiesel affirmed, and this is his words, "I have never renounced my faith in God. I have risen against his justice, protested his silence and sometimes his absence, but my anger rises up within faith and not outside it. I admit that this is hardly an original position. It is part of Jewish tradition. Abraham and Moses, Jeremiah and Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev teach us that it is permissible for man to accuse God, provided it be done in the name of faith in God. If that hurts, so be it. Sometimes we must accept the pain of faith so as not to lose it." In 1997, Wiesel wrote an op-ed in the New York Times addressing God directly. It begins, "Master of the universe, let us make up. It is time. How long can we go on being angry?" That op-ed, and you can look it up, it's online, is called "A Prayer for the Days of Awe." And it is incredibly moving, where Elie Wiesel, given all of his experiences, almost calls a truce. "Let's stop fighting. Let's be with one another, a Jew and HaKadosh Baruch Hu." Memory for Elie Wiesel, however painful, however difficult, must endure. And not just for memory's sake, but to inspire and guide the next generation. In an incredible interview from 2013, he was asked, "What do you tell a young Jewish generation about their indebtedness to history? 6 million Jews died al Kiddush Hashem to sanctify God's name. Therefore what?" His response was three words: "Therefore be Jewish." In 1973, he wrote a poem called "Ani Mamim," a song lost and found again, that really sums up the shards of faith that he refused to surrender no matter the horrors that he witnesses. And this is how it goes: "I believe in you, even against your will, even if you punish me for believing in you. Blessed are the fools who shout their faith. Blessed are the fools who go on laughing, who mock the man, who mocks the Jew, who helps their brothers, singing over and over, 'I believe. I believe in the coming of the Messiah, and though he tarries, I wait daily for his coming. I believe.'" The Akedah, returning to our original questions, is never really over. The story ends with Avraham sacrificing the ram caught in the shrubbery, the aisle that is Nechaz B'Sfach. This is much more than a postscript. It is the symbol of the actual and real sacrifices that Jews have made over the generations for their faith. And sadly, those committed to destroying the Jewish people never heeded the words of the angel, "Do not touch the child or do him any harm." Instead, the symbolic sacrifice of Yitzchak and the very real sacrifice of the aisle gives meaning and purpose to all future persecution. In one of the most haunting passages in Eish Kodesh, what he said on the yahrzeit of losing his child, the famed Rav of Piasetzna, Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapira, he writes, I'll read it in Hebrew because the words are so powerful, and then of course I'll translate, and this is published in Eish Kodesh in his Drusha, his sermon on Sukkos. He writes, "Lachain gam ha'akeda lo nisayon li Yitzchak le Vad Haisa, Rak Hatchala La Avoda Shall Masiris Nefesh La Hashem Li Yisroel." The sacrifice was not a challenge for Yitzchak alone, but it was the beginning of the service of sacrificing and giving up everything, Masiris Nefesh, for God by the Jewish people. The Kevin Shenisyono Shall Avram Vyitzchak Hayaratan Umachshava Shalol Nishmu Bapoa Lagamri. Avraham and Yitzchak were not able to actualize completely their will and their commitment to be willing to give up everything, because ultimately someone else stood in Yitzchak's stead, namely that ram. Ki amar lo hamalach al tishlach yadcha el anar. Avram was told not to do it. Lachain kol maisa Yisrael hanerogim de akum shehu lehepach. Anytime a Jew throughout history that is killed by our oppressors, and it's really the opposite, he writes. Maisa below machshava. It is the act of sacrifice without the thought, without the willingness that Yitzchak and Avram displayed. Tashlum akedas Yitzchaku. This is the fulfillment, this is the complement of akedas Yitzchak that continues to resound throughout the generation, sadly, of all those sacrificed in Jewish history. Shesham, in the akedah, haisa ha'atchala machshava. That was the beginning of the machshava v'ratzon, the kan hasi. And here in this generation, he is writing during the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust, where the Piasetzner Rebbe lost everything. And in his generation, it is almost the conclusion. It is one story where the Akedah, we had the Ratzon, the desire and the commitment, but without the action. And throughout the generations, anytime a Jew is killed al Kiddush Hashem, regardless of what their machshava level of commitment would be, you have the Maisa and not necessarily the Machshava. And the story of the Akedah sadly continues until today. And this brings us back to the mysterious dialogue between Avram and Yitzchak. Vayomer Yitzchak el Avram Aviv, Vayomer Avi, Vayomer Hineni Bini. In that seventh pasuk in the 22nd chapter of our parsha. What is the meaning of this exchange? What were they sharing with one another? I think this conversation between Yitzchak and Avraham captures the intergenerational relationship that the Akedah represents. One generation drawing support from the other, each carrying one another. Yitzchak, beginning to realize the momentous sacrifice that was about to occur, turned to his model of strength, Avraham, father, Avi. You give me strength. Your dedication gives me strength. Your love, kerachim of albanim, gives me strength. And Avram looked at Yitzchak and said, Hineni bini, here I am, my son. Avram looked at his child and all of the sacrifice Yitzchak was about to endure and said, do you know where I find strength? Do you know who my model for dedication is? Hineni bini. I am here because of you, my son. You, my son, bini, give me strength. In 1976, Elie Wiesel published Messengers of God, Biblical Portraits and Legends, and given his life experiences, it should come as no surprise that an entire essay entitled The Sacrifice of Isaac, A Survivor's Story, revisits the story of the Akedah through the lens of the horrors that Elie Wiesel witnessed. As a child, Wiesel writes, I read and reread this tale. My heart beating wildly, I felt dark apprehension come over me and carry me away. At the heart of the essay is a simple yet profound idea. Yitzchak is the first survivor. He concludes the essay as follows. Let us return to the question we asked at the beginning. Why was the most tragic of our ancestors named Isaac, a name which evokes and signifies laughter? Here is why. As the first survivor, he had to teach us, the future survivors of Jewish history, that it is possible to suffer and despair an entire lifetime and still not give up the art of laughter. Isaac, of course, never freed himself from the traumatizing scenes that violated his youth. The Holocaust had marked him and continued to haunt him forever. Yet he remains capable of laughter, and in spite of everything, he did laugh. And it is our responsibility to continue to serve as witnesses, as well as post-witnesses, to the sacrifices that occurred throughout the generations of Jewish history. And in spite of everything, we continue to bear witness. Thank you so much for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. You can, of course, sign up to our Substack, where you will get the write-up of the weekly class, as well as links to all of the articles and ideas that I quoted throughout the class. You can sign up at readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode, and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I am so grateful for your partnership and friendship. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading every single Shabbos.